As your honors are well aware, we are here today to discuss an issue that this court addressed a little more than a year ago, the interaction between the statutory right to inspection of a corporation's books and records and a pendant derivative action, and whether the rights to inspect are in any way impacted by the pendency, either before a demand letter or after, of a subsequently filed derivative action. I start with three basic premises which the court is well aware of. One, it's clear that we have to have a proper purpose for demand, but that looking for corporate mismanagement with the end game of potential litigation is certainly one of those proper purposes. This court's opinions are replete with that particular standard. Second, it's clear that the right to a 220 inspection is independent of other rights. There are a number of court cases in the Chancery Court that is so held. I believe Your Honor Justice Steele held so wrote in when he was a vice chancellor. And that's an important aspect, as I think the court recognized in Verifone, because there's been a lot of case law, certainly at the Chancery Court level, suggesting that the 220 right is really much more like discovery, and should you allow discovery in the context of derivative action when, in fact, in most derivative cases, discovery is stayed. But it's quite clear, and I think this court so recognized in Verifone, that 220 is not discovery. It is much more limited discovery, and it's a different beast, if you will. Discovery in a case, as we all know as lawyers, comes from the fact that you're a litigant in a particular lawsuit. You've maybe survived a motion to dismiss, number of circumscribed rights. 220 has nothing to do. You do not have to be a litigant. And all 220 is that every shareholder, regardless of what they're doing, where they are, is if they can state a proper purpose for a demand, then they can get the books and records that are permissible under 220. Because I think that's an important point to keep in mind, because there's been enormous discussion of, is it burdensome on a corporation while it is in the fact of, litigation to also have to bear the burden of doing the 220 books and records inspection. I would say there should be no issue about that. If I'm a shareholder, just because corporation is involved in litigation with somebody else, should that impact my rights, even if I'm not a litigant? I'm a shareholder. I have the right. It's equally burdensome whether I'm a litigant.
Mr. Jervis.
Yes.
Before we wander off too much into an excursus about the law generally, let's focus on this case. Was there a stay of discovery?
Yes, there was, Ron.
And
agreed to by the parties.
I gather that your position is that despite the stay of discovery and the derivative action, your client would be entitled to go forward on the 220 action that was filed simultaneously, correct?
Yes, that is our position.
Okay. Is it also your position that, as a general matter, there's no case law or other rule that precludes filing a derivative action and a Section 220 action at the same time?
I am not aware of any. I know there are Chancery Court decisions, certainly prior to this Court's decision, but I'm not aware of a rule that precludes that, Your Honor.
Let me rephrase it. Is it your position that a shareholder should be entitled to file a derivative action and a 220 action simultaneously?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
What then do we make of the body of case law that makes it clear, if not expressly, at least implicitly, that the purpose of filing a 220 action in connection with a possible derivative action would be to gather or develop whatever facts are needed to overcome a futility dismissal motion, but all of which would counsel filing the derivative action, if at all, after the 220 action?
I make of it that it clearly is a preference stated by the Chancery Court and certainly by this court as recently, at least as Verifone, perhaps even more recently than that, that there is a strong preference for filing a 220 action prior to the beginning of a derivative action. But I think this court's also clearly held in Verifone that while that is a preference and an admonishment, it was not a specific requirement. In fact, I think this court said it was specifically not a requirement that you have to file a 220 first. And I think there are many circumstances, and I think this case is one of them, where filing a 220 action prior to the filing of a derivative action would have been potentially impossible. Let me explain. We filed, as your honor is aware, we filed a demand letter. We waited 6 days. We got no response. Then we simultaneously filed, or not simultaneously, I think we filed a derivative action, then the 220 action about an hour later. But this was in the context of the deal.
Why is that legally relevant? I mean, if
well, it was.
Let me finish.
Oh, sure. I'm sorry.
Your position rises or falls, does it not, on the proposition?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your position rises or falls, does it not, on the proposition that a shareholder who's contemplating a possible derivative action can file the derivative action at the same time as a 220 action without any encumbrance or limitation on that shareholder's right to proceed with the 220 action, even if there's a stay of discovery. Is that right?
I wouldn't quite agree to that, Your Honor. I would say our position is that twofold. One, I mean, I would agree with that position, but I think our first position is we filed a 220 demand letter first. At the time, there was no derivative action pending. At the time we filed the letter, we had unequivocally a proper purpose to investigate mismanagement with the potential endgame of bringing a derivative action. We then subsequently filed a derivative action after we had received no response in the expiration of the time of the statutory time frame.
Are you distinguishing between filing a 220 action at the same moment as a derivative action, that's case one, or case two, filing a derivative action in minute one and then in minute two, the 220 action? Is that the distinction?
No, the distinction is between the actual demand letter, where we sent News Corp a letter setting forth our purposes, setting forth an affidavit, which is, I think we'll probably discuss, was missing a piece of paper, and asking for the production of those documents. They did not respond within the statutory five-day time period, at which point we then filed the derivative action, followed up, I think, an hour later by the 220 action, the complaint.
I've got a slightly different area of confusion, and that is with respect to other litigation. Is there not another derivative complaint in the courts alleging the same misconduct?
There have been, to my knowledge, Your Honor, three derivative complaints filed. The one that is filed in part by Central Laborers was first, I believe a week or so later, was a second one that was immediately consolidated, and then earlier this year was a third one that was consolidated, say, 3 weeks ago, something like that. Other than those three, I am unaware of any other derivative actions. They have all been consolidated into the derivative, what we call the derivative action for the purposes of this case.
So there are no other proceedings involving either Section 220 demands or discovery or anything relating to litigation on this subject other than the 220 complaint and the consolidated derivative action?
That is my understanding, Your Honor, yes. If there is, I'm not aware of it.
And your counsel with respect to the consolidated derivative action as well?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay. Let me ask you a question about this case. It appears that as the matter progressed, you were permitted to file through stipulation an amended complaint. Is that correct?
Two amended complaints, Your Honor, and a consolidated complaint.
All right, but I'm talking about reading the Vice Chancellor's decisions. As I understand one of your arguments to be, no matter what happened during the course of these proceedings, at a point in time, after we were debating whether my 220 action, your 220 action, should be dismissed, there was a stipulation we could file an amended complaint, and therefore we were entitled to a 220 response so that we could prepare for the stipulated amended complaint. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The timeline, I think, is that the last thing that happened in this case prior to the order and then off proceedings in front of this court was on the 11th of August of last year, there was an oral argument. At that time, we had a stipulation in place that allowed us to file an amended complaint. Without a date specified, we ultimately decided, not having heard for, a month on the 220, that we didn't want to keep the underlying proceeding held up anymore, and we filed on, I believe it was September the 20th, the amended complaint. That's the operative complaint at this time.
All right, so my question is there a difference between resurrecting the 220 action that was the subject of this litigation for purposes of getting what you need before you file this amended complaint pursuant to the stipulation, or why can't you just file another 220 request and say, well, now that we've stipulated that we can file an amended complaint, here's our 220 request?
I mean, I guess we could have done that. We thought that we had a valid 220 in place, and the only question was whether there was a proper purpose at all. Did the derivative action somehow wipe that out? So it's not, I mean, and we always had that amendment, right? It's not clear that, I'm not sure what.
Well, I'm just trying to understand the record, and because, you know, this has been moving in a chronology that's kind of a, it's a, it hasn't been a static case. But is, I just want to make sure I understand that at the end of the day, you were permitted to file an amended complaint, and your argument appears to be under the case law. Now that you're in the position where you have authority to file an amended complaint, you ought to be able to proceed with the 220 action.
That is correct. That is certainly our, at least one of the arguments that we are making, depending on what the rule this court ultimately adopts. We believe that that's clearly within the framework of Verifone, Your Honor.
Two questions. Number one, although you may have gotten stipulated authority to file an amended complaint, there was never a vacation of the stay of discovery order. Is that correct?
That is correct. We in all of the stipulations that were entered at all points in time between every one of them had a stay in.
The contemplation was that if you were going to amend your complaint, you would do it without taking discovery in the derivative action.
Yes, that was correct, Your Honor.
Okay. The second question, in your oral presentation and in your brief, there has been a great deal of emphasis on the fact that the 220 action wasn't filed until after the requisite number of days expired to respond to the demand. My problem is discerning what the legal relevance of that is doctrinally, or to put it differently, what rule of law are you suggesting this court should articulate in an opinion were it to come out your client's way?
The rule of law that we were seeking to articulate, at least as to that particular piece, is that, that if you have a proper purpose on the day that you file your demand letter, that that proper purpose, well, clearly there are subsequent events that kind of impact one's 220 rights. You know, you can, if you get merged, so you're no longer a shareholder, you no longer have 220 rights. But our argument would be that the filing, the subsequent filing of a derivative action is not the kind of later event that strips an initial proper purpose and turns it into somehow an improper purpose. So the rule of law we propose is if you have an improper purpose on the or a proper purpose on the day you file your demand letter, the subsequent filing of a derivative action does not eliminate that proper purpose. Well, that is the law, rule of law.
Was there some issue about standing when you filed your demand letter?
There was not. We the issue, as I mean, we filed a demand letter attaching an affidavit which set forth our shareholdings and what they were in the context of the affidavit. It also referenced a true and correct copy of an account statement. The account statement was inadvertently not included. It was intended to be included. In fact, I believe that we're not aware it had not been attached to the letter until we were so advised by defendants when they filed their motion to dismiss, at which point we provided a copy of that missing account statement in the our opposition to the motion to dismiss. But the affidavit itself specifically said, here's the shares we owned, here's the accounts we own them in. So I don't believe there was ever a question of standing, Your Honor. There was a question as to whether we technically complied with 220, I believe.
So you're representing that there was no response to your demand letter for reasons other than your demand letter itself did not establish that you had standing to make the demand.
Well, I think that the defendants have so said. I mean, the first thing we got from them, first response was after we filed the complaint, I filed a motion to dismiss that had two grounds. One, they said you didn't attach the particular document that you actually referenced in the affidavit. I mean, we meant to attach it. It was referenced, and all the information was provided. And they said also, and by the way, regardless of that, you don't have a proper purpose. So, I mean, you can ask Mr. Varela whether they thought both of them or what.
I'm just trying to figure out the significance of filing the demand letter and having no response, triggering a right to file a 220 action after a derivative action is filed later. I'm trying to understand why that it has substance when there's an arguable issue that you haven't met a standing requirement when you send your demand letter. And it's more than just not attaching an affidavit. Wasn't there a misstatement about the beneficial ownership?
I think that the was we said record and we meant beneficial. It was in one place it was correct and one place it was incorrect. But We attached the affidavit.
It also addressed Viacom, didn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It also addressed Viacom.
Oh, yes. I believe someone put
it. As if it, some associate had drafted it out of a form book.
I think it was probably out of a other file 220. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm aware of that particular, yes. Very embarrassing.
It was out of no significance? I mean, you placed a lot of significance on the fact that the demand letter was sent, as if there was no reason for someone not responding promptly to it. And I'm suggesting maybe there were reasons someone didn't.
I can understand that. We of course, did not know that. But, two things. The rule of law, assuming it had been a valid demand letter, I suspect we'd still be here. But is that in response to your question was, had it been proper, then the proper purpose should have attached at the time of the fine demand letter, and the subsequent event shouldn't have checked that. To try and respond more directly to Your Honor's question, our second position would be, in light of Verifone, even once we sort of cured the defect by actually providing the missing account statement, so it was clear that everything, that the defendants had everything to which they were entitled, if he was, at that point in time, we had a complete demand letter in front of them, and we should have then been able to even, assuming that we didn't bring it until that date, assuming that the demand letter was not brought until the date that we had actually provided to them the missing account statement, still should have had the ability, even though at that point in time there was a pending derivative action and the 220 letter would have come later, that the fact of the, I think what Verifone clearly holds is as long as you have the right to amend and use the documents that you'd obtained through a 220 action in a derivative proceeding, that we would still have had a proper purpose. And in this case, at the time, I believe it was in April, that we actually provided them with the missing account statement, we still had not used up our first as-of-right amendment because we'd filed a consolidated complaint. We had an as-of-right amendment, and then we were subsequently granted the right to yet another amendment by the court. So for many months thereafter, we had the right to amend. So I think under the clear holding of Verifone, we were okay even at that later point, assuming arguendo that the earlier letter was, as Your Honor suggested, completely null and void because it did not attach the account statement.
Well, let me follow up on that a little bit. Are you saying that Verifone held that you are automatically entitled to pursue a 220 action as long as you have a right to amend your derivative action?
That is how I read the opinion, Your Honor. I know it has been the court in my case specifically noted that the only right of Verifone was at the end, but what he suggested was at the end of the case at the time of the motion to dismiss. I know that thereafter the court in Amalgamated versus NetApp sort of said as long as you have an explicit right to amend, that you have been granted the right to amend, you're okay. The position we had in mind, and I believe I argued below, was that as long as you have not been denied the right to amend, where all amendments have been precluded, as, say, for example, in the Beiser case upon which this court relied, you're okay. I would argue, obviously, that position. I could see the amendment as of right position. I think the one that you have to wait till the end of the case is probably flatly inconsistent with Rule 15 AAA. But does that answer?
Well, let me explain my problem, and maybe you can help me with it. The common practice, as I understand it, upon the filing of a derivative complaint or a class action complaint is frequently a motion to dismiss for whatever reasons and a stay of request for and a granted stay of discovery, right? I mean, that's kind of a typical course of conduct, right?
Yes. In fact, it's so typical we agreed to the stay of discovery. We didn't even make them fight it.
All right. And at the same time, a Section 220 action is, although clearly not the same as discovery, also very much related to getting information that you otherwise would have wanted to get through discovery, correct?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. So it sounds as if what's going on is you really need some discovery in order to hopefully survive the motion to dismiss, but you don't want to wait around, so you use your 220 action so that you can get around the stay of discovery in the derivative litigation. I mean, is there something wrong with the way I'm connecting these two actions?
Well, I think the actual thrust of what you say is quite accurate. I mean, I don't get around it. At the time we agreed to the stay of discovery, and it was all known to everyone, we had filed a 220 action at that point. So we agreed to a stay of discovery with the understanding of all parties that we were continuing to pursue our 220 rights. So it was never like, aha, we're going to agree to the stay of discovery and then backdoor you with this 220. We'd filed it, frankly, well before we agreed to a stay of discovery. And I believe there's something in there that says that it does not, you know.
But that's the practical effect, isn't it? You're backdooring to get discovery through 220?
That isn't, well, I would say that it's not quite like discovery, but in some sense, yeah, that would be a fair statement to say that the independent right accorded a shareholder, as a shareholder, as opposed to as a litigant, if I'm, for example, a litigant against a corporation that doesn't have that's not a shareholder, I don't have that right. No way to get around it. I'm out of time for this. I have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I can answer questions now, or you can get me at the end.
Well, if someone has a question, we would appreciate you answering it now. Otherwise, you can reserve your time. All right, your time is reserved. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Gregory Varello, and together with Jenner and Block, my firm and I represent defendant below Appellee News Corp. The two issues before the court today, the first is simply, must a shareholder who seeks documents pursuant to Section 220 of the General Corporation Law be required to comply with the statute in order to get access to the documents? And second, is a shareholder's purpose proper, and can a shareholder carry its burden of showing that the documents sought are essential to that purpose where those documents are conceitedly not necessary for the purpose sought? I would urge that the answer to the first question is yes and the second no. I will explain those answers and also demonstrate why King against Verifone does not read on this case. The relevant facts, which I'll briefly dwell on, are not contested. The plaintiff's demand seeks 20 different categories of documents with a date scope of 10 years for some of the requested documents and an unlimited date scope with others. The sworn purpose of the shareholder making the demand boils down to investigating alleged wrongdoing with the intention of bringing litigation and determining whether or not a majority of the board are independent and disinterested so as to determine whether or not demand is required prior to bringing derivative suit. Importantly, this is a demand, as the Chief Justice pointed out, which demands the books and records of Viacom Corporation. I don't represent Viacom Corporation, I represent News Corporation. More importantly, the affidavit attached to the demand refers to an annexed document showing plaintiff's beneficial ownership of News Corp. But as counsel told you, that annexed document was not attached to the demand.
Mr. Varello, just so I'll understand where you're going with this, is your point that this court could dispose of this appeal on that narrow factual ground without getting into all the loftier conceptual arguments?
That's precisely correct, Your Honor.
Vice Chancellor did not address this issue in any way, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. It was briefed before the Vice Chancellor. It was argued to the Vice Chancellor. In a footnote at the end of his opinion, the Vice Chancellor noted that he need not reach it because he decided the matter on other grounds. However, we've collected cases at footnote 5 of our brief explaining why this court has the right to consider that issue separately. And I note that given that the facts are not in dispute and that it's a pure issue of law, certainly it is an alternative ground on which the court could determine to decide the matter.
But help me with this. Opposing counsel has conceded, as he must, that the original demand was deficient, and they fixed it.
They did not fix it, Your Honor, and I think I can help you with that. Search high and low in this record. You will not find a second demand. There was no new demand served identifying the correct corporation, identifying whether they were record or beneficial holders, and attaching the required evidence of beneficial ownership that is mandated by the statute. This is not a guideline. This is not judge-imposed. This is a statutory mandate that is required. Now, what my friend did do is when he filed his answering brief in the court below, he submitted an affidavit attaching the missing document from the demand. But the rest of the demand was never fixed, and no new demand was served addressing the various other deficiencies that we pointed out in our motion to dismiss. So, Your Honor, if you go and read the Chancery Court's jurisprudence on curing demands, what you find is that in every case where a demand was found to have been cured, a defective ab initio demand was found to have been cured, in every one of those cases, a new demand was served in proper form in compliance with the mandates of Section 220 in every case.
So are you saying that if the court were to decide this matter and reach the question of the validity of the demand, that the court should hold that if there's any defect in your original demand, the only way to cure that defect is to file a whole new demand? You can't say, here's the missing document that wasn't attached. You can't say, please correct the typo on page 3 and make it say News Corp. You have to resubmit everything.
You do, Your Honor. And my friend, when asked the question below why he didn't resubmit the demand, if you look at page 37 of the transcript of the oral argument before Vice Chancellor Noble, what Mr. Jarvis said was, he didn't want to have to reset the clock. I'm paraphrasing, but effectively he said he didn't want to take the time necessary to do it right.
Okay, so let's get to time for a minute here, too.
Certainly.
Is there any reason, I know I'm asking a question that perhaps the other side would prefer to answer, but is there any reason why the 220 demand could not have been made properly, time allotted to respond, back and forth about what you will or will not produce, litigation if necessary, and then the filing of a derivative action? Is there something about the derivative claim that made it necessary to file that action when it was filed?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
So would it be fair to assume that maybe the reason it was filed is because there was some sense that others were also going to be filing?
Your Honor, it is fair to assume, and we have suggested as much before the lower court, that Mr. Jarvis and his firm wanted to win the race to the courthouse. As a matter of fact, when they filed the derivative action, they were challenging a transaction which had not yet closed. There was plenty of time. There was no issue of statute of limitations. If you look at the cases like Romero and Khanna in the court below, where the court has said, well, it might be okay to bring your 220 after you've brought your derivative case, were there exceptional circumstances? What were the exceptional circumstances? In those cases, for example, the statute of limitations was about to run on the derivative case. Here, my friend brought the derivative case before the statute of limitations even began to run, not as it was expiring. There was absolutely no reason other than to win the race to the courthouse. And, Your Honor, that gets me to a policy point. And I understand the court is struggling with the timing and how to do it and when to do it. But what we haven't yet sort of fleshed out in the arguments or in the questions is the policy rationale for doing it first. For 20 years, this court has been saying to derivative plaintiffs, use the tools at hand. Use them before you file your derivative complaint so that you can meet the high burden imposed by the particularized pleading requirements of Rule 23.1. You've said that repeatedly. I couldn't cite all the cases. They take me too much time. The fact of the matter is, when you adopt a rule, as my friend is arguing that you should adopt, allowing that 220 demand to be made and litigated after the derivative case has been filed, you do a couple of things. First of all, you incentivize the race to the courthouse, because now it doesn't matter what you file. As long as you've met Rule 11 and query whether a lot of these derivative suits do or not, but as long as you've met Rule 11, you're in, and then you can use 220 to get your real facts. The problem with that is 220 is designed to allow a company to make a decision as to whether or not to produce documents. Conceptually, there could be a case, I know this is hard for plaintiff's counsel to conceptualize, but there could be a case where a set of facts looks bad on a press release, but when you examine documents, you conclude, you know what, I am not going to waste the time and effort necessary to bring a derivative case because it's not a very good derivative case. There are certainly circumstances one could conceptualize of where you might not want to bring a derivative case after doing your 220 investigation. There are also many cases where you would want to, and in fact, by doing your 220 investigation, you would be able to put together a complaint which withstood the expected motion to dismiss. But as a rule, thinking about what it means for every case that comes after this, as a rule, if you say at any time during your derivative case that you have a right to seek to amend, you can then bring a 220 case, that just makes no sense. It drives a jurisprudence which is upside down, which is on its head. All the investigation gets done after the filing. I mean, think about what that means from the perspective of your corporate citizens who have spent the time and money necessary to bring the motion to dismiss only to find, to brief the motion to dismiss, only to find they then have to deal with a 220. This is about plaintiffs being responsible, using the tools at hand, but using them for an appropriate purpose. But let's think about requirements like proper purpose and essentiality for a moment, if we can.
Well, if I can interrupt you just for a moment. I'm curious about the how you sequenced your arguments in your brief and even here. In the normal appeal, the appellee starts out with arguments that go to the point that the trial court decided the issues below correctly, reasoning was correct, you should affirm. Following that, but if the court wishes to consider other arguments, here's an alternative ground. You flipped that sequence, and my question is there something we're missing here?
No, not at all, Your Honor. I flipped the sequence for a very deliberate reason. From a strategic point of view, I frankly was concerned that if I put it second, Your Honors wouldn't feel the need to deal with it. It's a statutory mandate. I think the case is easily disposable of on that ground, and so I put it first.
We would stop reading after your first argument.
Your Honor, this is an interesting question, the sequencing issue and the policy issues behind it. Certainly a court could decide that it wanted to wrestle with that question, and you're all together, so perhaps you do, and I'm more than happy to talk about it at any length. But to the extent that Your Honors want to look at the matter and make a judgment without necessarily having to delve into that issue, the statutory basis gives you the basis to do that, and that's why I put it first. Certainly meant no disrespect, and certainly meant no lack of interest. Right. Certainly meant to signal the lack of interest in the other argument.
Mr. Varallo, at least in my mind, the issues are linked more closely, I think, than the Vice Chancellor thought they were linked because of the argument that I've just heard from appellant, which suggested that one of the reasons we should conclude it's okay to file the 220 after there's been a stay of discovery and after the derivative suit was filed was because, in effect, it's retroactive to the filing of the demand letter. And we're not going to cure it to meet the statutory requirements because if we did, we would have to admit that it was defective. And if it's defective, maybe that trigger that it causes to justify the later 220 action won't work. So to me, they're totally interrelated and unless I'm missing something. And it seems to me you start with whether or not this significant filing of the demand letter was valid under the statute or not before you get to the next point. But that's only the way I'm looking at it.
Your Honor, and obviously, you know, when you look at King versus Verifone and the issues that the court was struggling with there was a question as to whether we were dealing with judge-made rules or statutory rules. And the other reason we started with the statute is because the commands of the statute are very clear. And you don't get to triggering all this timing if you start with a defective demand. and you don't try to cure many of the issues in the demand. The only thing that was...
Let me ask you that. Assuming any of what we've just said has any merit, the real question in my mind remains, going forward, what if this was a statutorily perfected demand letter? What significance, as a matter of policy, should that have on the filing of a 220 action after a derivative complaint?
Your Honor, it should have a significant impact that the derivative case was filed before the 220 demand, assuming for purposes of argument that the 220 demand was effective, statutorily effective on its face. The reason for that, as a policy matter, is if you think about essentiality, and if the purpose of the demand is to determine facts, to determine whether or not I have to make a demand on the board prior to instituting derivative litigation, and I then file that derivative litigation without waiting to get those facts, they can't be essential. By definition, it cannot be essential to get to documents under 220 where you've made the choice to go ahead and sign the pleading which says that a majority of this board is allegedly not independent and disinterested.
That essentially captures the gist of the Vice Chancellor's ruling, except that that ruling is couched in terms of purpose rather than essentiality. Is that correct?
It is, Your Honor, and the question is, I think the next sort of question down for Your Honor is whether essentiality is linked to purpose or not. I think the two merge here. They can be distinguished. They can be analyzed.
Essentiality generally goes to the scope of the remedy, whereas purpose is a foundational element going to whether any relief at all can be granted.
I agree with Your Honor, but I think that in this particular set of facts, the two merge. And I think they merge because of the logical, the extremely logical foundational point that if you are seeking documents for a particular end and that end is already met, you neither have a proper purpose nor can the documents be essential.
Well, what's wrong with the argument that I have enough facts to file a complaint, but I can make it better and I have the absolute right to amend, therefore the 220 action should be allowed to proceed?
Your Honor, there's nothing wrong with that argument except the timing of it. If you have enough facts to bring a derivative case and you want to make it better, as a policy matter, you ought to make it better before you file the derivative action, not after. And it's not only purpose and essentiality, it's the impact on every derivative case that's going to be filed here. If you do it that way, you institutionalize a regime where okay cases are filed and then there's satellite 220 litigation filed on top of them. And from a case management perspective for the trial court, you've increased the difficulty, you've cut into judicial efficiency and economy, and you've added a layer of costs on the defendants. If, and as I said earlier, I know this is hard to imagine from a plaintiff's lawyer's point of view, but if you had done your investigation under 220 prior to filing, there will be some cases, trust me, there will be some cases where a plaintiff lawyer gets those documents and says it's simply not worth the candle to bring this particular derivative case.
How would your rule work? Let's suppose hypothetically you file this derivative claim and then in your 220 action you say the purpose of my 220 action is to improve my complaint by amending as a matter of right. That's my purpose. Applying your rule, what does the Court of Chancery do?
First, Your Honor, that's a purpose that's never been recognized by the court, but let's just assume arguendo that it is a proper purpose. I think what the Court of Chancery does is to say, look, you have options here. One option is to exercise your right under Rule 41A of the Chancery Court rules to dismiss without prejudice and then prosecute your 220 action. Another option is to bring that 220 action prior to filing your derivative complaint. But under Rule 11B3 of the Chancery Court rules, when you sign your name to a pleading that you file in the Court of Chancery, you make a representation that there is evidence in the words of the rule, sufficient to ground your factual allegations. So, Your Honor,
does your answer to my question turn on whether it's a proper purpose? You lost me when you said it's never been recognized as a proper purpose. Tell me what is the Court of Chancery going to say? We don't recognize that as a proper purpose in Delaware, or something else?
Your Honor, a Court of Chancery, when dealt with this particular set of facts, could very well say it's not a proper purpose because of the timing of the case. That is to say, making it better is something you should have done earlier, or making it better is something you can do independently by exercising your right under 41A, but not while your derivative case is pending.
Let me follow up on that using, to some extent, your own position, which is that the statute says what's required, and that's that, and it must be complied with. I don't recall seeing anything in the statute that says that you have to do this before you do anything else.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you're suggesting that the court adopt a rule that says, although Section 220 is open-ended as to when you can file it and when you can have the right to receive necessary documents, we're going to cut it off at the point at which litigation, substantive litigation, has begun.
You already have, Your Honor, and let me direct you to King versus Verifone, and specifically this court's decision at 12A3rd 1150, and this is the court describing its holding in that case. Quote, "The result we reach here reaffirms longstanding Delaware precedent, which recognizes that it is a proper purpose under Section 220 to inspect books and records that would aid the plaintiff in pleading demand futility in a to-be-amended complaint in a plenary derivative action where the earlier filed plenary complaint was dismissed on demand futility-related grounds without prejudice and with leave to amend," close quote. It's very, very careful language, clearly construing what the holding of King versus Verifone means. And it,
well,
I don't.
I'm missing something here, because what I understand you to be saying is that Section 220, a Section 220 proceeding must occur prior to the filing of a substantive complaint, except in the specific circumstance that's been, you've just described.
Two times, Your Honor, before the filing of the complaint or after the dismissal without prejudice of the complaint with leave to replead.
Okay, but I guess what I'm asking is, I don't know of any case law that says when a plaintiff has filed a derivative complaint and then after that filed a Section 220 action and said, my proper purpose is to find more information to help this complaint survive, where this court or the Court of Chancery has said, you didn't file it first, and therefore you're out.
Your Honor, the Court of Chancery, I think, in a number of cases has come to that conclusion. I would commend Your Honor's attention to a case called Baca versus Insight Enterprises, and I would start by telling you that the court's ruling in that case relies on the lower court's King decision, although the articulated rationale is consistent with King as decided by this court, with all due respect. So I think there is at least one such case, but that's not this court, and we're here before this court.
Mr. Borrello, before the time runs out, you did indicate that you were going to argue that King versus Verifone, that is this court's decision, doesn't read on this case at all. Is that a fair statement?
And if that's
right, can you elaborate?
I'd be happy to. Your Honor, the rule of King versus Verifone is importantly qualified by the language I read to the court, which appears at page 1150 of the reported decision. In particular, the rule is described as applying in a circumstance, quote, where the earlier filed plenary complaint was dismissed without prejudice and with leave to amend, close quote. That's from 1150 of Your Honor's decision. This is not a case that falls into that procedural category. This is a case where the underlying case continues, and my friend is attempting to use 220 in a context that is different than the carefully limited holding in King. Your Honor, I could go on, but that's the effect.
I want to ask you a question about the first argument in your brief and the statement you made earlier that the remedy for a defective demand is a new demand. And it seemed that there's some support for your position in Seinfeld and Verizon where we talk about balancing 220 actions and the ability of the business to conduct its business while still responding to proper demands. So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is if 220 is going to work, corporations should only have to respond to proper demands and not ones that are kind of cut and pasted together and finally get it right at some point.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And just as a matter of this case and what procedurally happened here, on the 20th day when our answer was due, we filed a motion to dismiss in the Court of Chancery, but we did not avail ourselves of the right to simply file the one paragraph motion to dismiss. We filed the motion to dismiss with our opening brief. So 20 days to the day, my friend knew exactly what our position was on his case, and he brought his case the day after the statutory minimum day. So 26 days after he made his demand, he knew exactly what our position was, fully briefed. So there's no hiding the ball. There was no failure to meet any obligation. Our obligation is triggered by response to a lawsuit or a proper demand. We had a improper demand, and we responded to the lawsuit with our full brief and the full panoply of our arguments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
I'd like to make a couple quick points. Just on the sort of the Viacom, which was a clear improper mistake on our part. We did use the word Viacom once and probably used the word News Corp 10 times in demand, so it's pretty clear it was a typo that there was no, that they knew that it was aimed at them, not at Viacom. It was in one spot in the last paragraph.
But in that regard, just as a matter of the way things should work in 220, it's possible somebody could figure that out, but why shouldn't people, as a matter of course, have to comply with the statute? And if you don't comply with the statute, then you file a new demand. And what Mr. Valero points out is that it wasn't simply Viacom versus News Corp. It was Record versus Beneficial Shareholder, and then there wasn't an attachment. With a corporation that's publicly traded with so many shareholders, why shouldn't they be able to look at it, say this isn't a proper demand, file a new one?
I can understand that. We saw
right,
it.
Question.
We saw it as most of the cases that we looked at were ones where someone either clearly missed a piece of,
three pretty major things. Wrong corporation, wrong distinction between beneficial and record ownership, and no attachment.
We saw the third of those as the most significant, and it was clearly a technical or a clerical oversight. We thought that by properly providing it in our opposition brief with the explanation, that constituted an effective amendment because there was no intent on our part not to include it. It's not like we thought we didn't need it. We clearly understood that we did need it, and we intended to attach it, and it was just not. So we thought that by providing them, which we could if they'd done it at the outset, which they did not have to do. Mr. Vallo is quite right that they followed the law and procedure properly, we thought we had cured the issue without need to, and I think I did say below, reload the process. I actually didn't have in mind some of the arguments we presented here about when the proper purpose attached, more than that by that time we were 2 months in and we didn't want to have to go through the whole 2 months again just to get back to the same spot. We thought we could, you know, try to get to the real issue, which was the question of whether we had a proper purpose with the pendency of a derivative action.
You heard what I asked Mr. Varallo, and I want to make sure you have an opportunity to answer it. Let's assume for a moment that the demand letter was perfectly consistent with the statutory mandate. Forget about the mistakes that were made. What is the significance of relating back to the demand letter in your argument that it's okay to file the 220 after the derivative action because, after all, it really relates back to the demand letter? So the demand letter came before the derivative suit. That should be good enough. Is that not your argument, or am I just misunderstanding?
No, that's certainly one. I mean, if one were to presume that we had an effective demand letter
that the amendment sort of cured and related back, if you will, that then when the proper purpose is, when do you, at some point you have to measure a point in time when there's a proper purpose. When is that? We say it's at the time of the demand letter. I mean, I guess you could say it's at the time of the filing of the complaint, or they argued in their brief at the time of the decision on the 220 case is when you look at the facts to determine what the proper purpose is. And while we acknowledge that facts can change, we would say a derivative is not one that, if you had a proper purpose at the start, it doesn't change. But I want to address on the timing issue that was suggested that we had no purpose other than race to the courthouse in order to bring the derivative complaint we did. And that's simply not accurate. As I think Mr. Varela pointed out, at the time of the filing of the complaint, the transaction issue had not yet closed. And we filed it, I think, with the initial intent of probably moving to enjoin. We then subsequently thought about it and did not then seek expedited proceedings, and we thought we could probably get away with money damages. I'm out of time. I'm sorry.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.